You're listening to the Evil Orphan Murder Trial of Dima Tower from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Please always give them my best.
Absolutely. Good
morning. I keep meaning to reach out. I think she became a county judge up there.
Yes. She ran. Good
morning.
Yeah.
She ran up there. I was very happy about that. Like she's,
yeah, because she's not necessarily, I don't think, has connections or has great wealth or
sister. No. And she was one of the prosecutors that you could deal with. You know, there were some of them up there that
had some reason and some perspective.
Yeah. There were some of them up there that did not.
Jury instructions. Do each of you have a proposed packet in front of you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is from the email that Ms. Friedland sent yesterday. But I have it open to make any edits.
Great. Let's take a look at it. Introduction to final instructions. We'll go page by page. Any objection to this by either side?
No objection, Your Honor.
No, Your
Honor. Now, let me just remind just some Mr. Tower understands. We're having this jury instruction. We call it a charge conference. We're having this early because time allows us to have this discussion. This doesn't mean these are permanent. There could be changes that happen based on the additional evidence presented. Once the state closes their case in chief, your attorney will make arguments. So we haven't had motions yet. So this is an early look at jury instructions, Mr. Tower. This isn't a final discussion. We'll have another discussion once we've closed all the evidence before we were to read this to the jurors, okay?
Your Honor, just a question. Do you prefer like page numbers in the jury?
No, I don't need page numbers. Does the defense have any preference? My preference would be not to do page numbers.
I would not like them either.
Okay.
All right, next is statement of charges. Again, in this case, we had the defendant was indicted on two counts of first degree murder. I granted the state's motion to consolidate those two counts with the fleeing to elude. Because he was indicted with first degree murder, the second degree murder charges that were initially filed were declined. I think there was a written order to that effect, not order, but motion by the memo by the state. Is that right, Emily? Did Ms. Frablich bring something over to you on Wednesday on the second-degree murder charges?
Yes, but I believe there needs to be further clarification.
Further clarification. Okay. So these...
It was clarified. Yes.
It was clarified. All right. So these appear to me to be the statement of the charges that the court allowed to go forward on. Count one is murder in the first degree. The state identified Mr. Gilman to make one and two unique. They put in the alleged victim.
Yes, Your Honor.
I think that's appropriate. Do you have any objection to that?
I do not.
And then count three is fleeing to elude. They also inserted here to identify it, siren and lights activated. Again, we'll get to that later, but they're lesser included. So I think that's appropriate. Any objection to the statement of charges page?
No, Your Honor.
All right, next we have 7.1, introduction to homicide. Unless expressly waived by both parties, this must be read in all homicide cases. I've reviewed it. The state just inserted the correct pronouns. They do have, Mr. Gilman, both lesser included counts of murder in the second degree and manslaughter inserted. And they have the defendant's name, Dima Tower, inserted as well. It appears to me, as I went through it and compared it to our Supreme Court version, that it's legally accurate. Do either side have any objection?
No, Your Honor.
No.
All right, next we have 7.2. This is the instruction on murder first degree. It has the statute number. I have compared this to the Supreme Court version. It appears to be legally accurate. It has the defendant's and the defendant and alleged victim's names. Now, they're all capitalized. The state has been consistent throughout doing that. Is there any objection by either side to that, to capitalizing the names? I think it's usually done. I can't think of any prejudice to capitalizing
the
name. It's not in any way...
I don't think I have any objection to it, Your Honor.
And I'm going to see.
Is
All right, any objection to this instruction as it relates? So this is count one. This is with Jennifer Tower as the alleged victim.
No objection, Your Honor.
No objection.
All right, count two. It's the same exact instruction, except if you look at element one and three, instead of Jennifer Tower, it now has Robbie Tower, which is consistent with the state's indictment that Robbie Tower is the victim, alleged victim in count two. Any objection to this instruction?
No, Your Honor.
Next is 28.7. Again, I did already compare these to our Supreme Court version. I found no mistake in this either. Names are capitalized. The defendant's name is inserted. There's no victim name here. It has the definitions. It has the three elements correctly outlined. Any objection to this by either side?
No, Your Honor. The only issue is there is a, I don't know if you want to take the brackets out of the vehicle definition.
I definitely think we should. I missed that. Yeah. Thank you for catching that.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, let's address the lesser included crimes to count one. They are murder in the second degree and manslaughter. Are either side requesting those?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's appropriate to include these. The state appropriately did here. So we have murder in the second degree and manslaughter. For fleeing to elude, the two lesser included in the definition are fleeing to elude without sirens and lights and reckless driving. Are either side requesting either of those?
No, Your Honor.
State?
So defense is not requesting any lesser included for?
The fleeing to elude?
The fleeing to elude.
Correct.
Okay. We'll request the first, the felony fleeing to elude.
Okay. So you want to make the argument that there were no lights and sirens activated. Okay, let's keep in fleeing to elude without lights and sirens. Both sides agree not to have reckless driving. State, defense?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll remove reckless driving. All right, so we now have the definition. So we're now going to get into the lesser included. The state did one, which is probably appropriate for each count one and count two. So the first one is murder, second degree. They inserted victim Jennifer Tower. So this is the lesser included for count one. I compared it to the standard instruction. It's legally accurate. The portion that's in the standard instruction that the state has not included is the whole discussion on negligence. Do both sides agree that does not apply?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree as well. Any objection to this instruction?
No, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think it's legally accurate. Again, I compared it to the Supreme Court version, and it is the same. All right, next we're still on count one now. The lesser included crime is manslaughter. They inserted victim Jennifer Tower again. It shows to the jury that this is still count one. It has the two elements. Again, I compared this to the book. It is accurate. Any objection by either side?
No, Your Honor.
All right, we're now moving to count two. This says victim Robbie Tower. Count two first-degree murder is second-degree murder. It's the same instruction as the lesser included as to count one, although instead of Jennifer Tower, we have Robbie Tower inserted. Any objection by either side to this?
No, Your Honor.
State?
No.
Okay, we also have the manslaughter instruction for count two. This is the victim, Robbie Tower. They inserted the defendant's name, victim's name. Otherwise, it's the same instruction. Any objection?
No, Your Honor.
All right, we have the lesser included for fleeing to elude, which is fleeing to elude. Any objection? Oh, we need to do what Mr. Gilman pointed out before. You still have the bracketed part in the vehicle definition. Can you remove that?
Yeah.
Once that's done, any objection to this instruction?
No, Your Honor.
All right, reckless driving will be removed. Good morning, Ms. Fravlig.
Good morning, Your Honor.
All right, next in my packet is 3.7, plea of not guilty, reasonable doubt, and burden of proof. This appears to be the old version. We need to get the updated version, 2025. The only difference is that in the paragraph that begins, a reasonable doubt is not a mere possible doubt. That paragraph has changed, and that paragraph now begins, proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean proof beyond all doubt. Are you able to get the updated version?
Yes, sir.
Other than that, it's the same. Once that change is made, is there any objection by either side?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I'll give you a moment, Ms. Whipple. Let me know when you finish that.
Sometimes.
All right.
Okay. Next, I have 3.9, weighing the evidence. Okay, we have 1 through 5 that are given in all cases. So what we don't have is 6 through 10. So let me just read them out loud and let's see if we think so far any apply or if you can anticipate perhaps. Number 6, has the witness been offered or received any money, preferred treatment, or other benefit in order to get the witness to testify?
I would not think that applies.
State?
Agrees.
All right. Did you say agrees?
Agrees, yes.
Okay.
I agree.
All right, so right now we think 6 does not apply. 7, had any pressure or threat been used against the witness that affected the truth of the witness's testimony?
I do not anticipate that testimony either.
No, it doesn't apply, Your Honor.
Okay. 8, did the witness at some other time make a statement that is inconsistent with the testimony he or she gave in court? I don't think we've had impeachment so far. We'll see how it plays out. I think we have, you know, we'll see how the rest of the trial plays out. But so far we agree it wouldn't apply.
Correct.
All right. 9, has the witness been convicted of a felony or a crime of dishonesty? There's been none of that so far. We'll see if that changes for the remainder of the trial. 10, does the witness have a general reputation for dishonesty or truthfulness? There's been no testimony related to that. So far I would agree that 6 through 10 don't apply. We'll have to readdress this at the end of the evidence. All right, whether the state has met its burden remains in. The fact that a witness is employed in law enforcement, we give in all cases. Expert witnesses can remain in. We didn't have any accomplice or informant, so that was correctly not included. There's been no child witness. We'll wait to see if Mr. Tower testifies. Whether or not to include that or exclude it. Proper for a witness to talk to the lawyers and relying upon your own testimony. So this appears to me to be legally accurate right now. The only issue is when we find whether or not Mr. Tower testifies, we'll address that. The next one, 3.9A, defendant not testifying. We'll wait to see what Mr. Tower chooses to do. 3.9B, defendant's statements. We have that here. We have a statement that was played to the jury yesterday. This is something the jury should take into consideration, this instruction. I've compared it to the Supreme Court version. This appears to me to be legally accurate. Any objection by either side?
No, Your Honor.
No.
3.10, rules for deliberation. All of them are included except the jurors talking about questions they asked. Of course, they didn't in this trial. So this appears to me to be legally accurate. Any objection by either side?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Cautionary instruction is legally accurate. I will read that, of course. 3.12A, we have single defendant, multiple counts. Can you get rid of and informations in the title portion there?
I just called it charging documents.
Can we just get rid of it?
Yeah.
I think single defendant, multiple counts is the issue that the jury, we're honing them in on here.
Thank you.
So let's see, you have a separate crime as charged in each count of the charging. Can you make that singular document? I granted a motion to consolidate, so we don't need them to be thinking that we have an information and an indictment. I think that's irrelevant.
Yes, sir.
But we do need them to know that there's multiple counts and they need to consider them separately. So let's see. A separate crime is charged in each count of the charging document. You're getting rid of the S. And although they have been tried together, each crime and the evidence applicable to it must be considered separately and a separate verdict returned as to each. This now appears to be legally accurate to me. Any objection once we remove and informations and the S in documents?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Whipple, were you able to make those changes?
Yes, sir.
All right, the verdict instruction 3.12 seems appropriate. Any objection?
No objection.
All right, verdict looks good to me as well, that the state listed, I think, appropriately consistent with the jury instructions. They listed the alleged victim to identify the difference between count one and two. They have the lesser included. It's perfectly lined up. There's nothing italicized or drawing attention to anyone in particular. Guilty and not guilty are not capitalized throughout.
Count three.
Your Honor, I did for count three, but this isn't my intersection. Initially, there wasn't the lesser included, but can I talk with Ms. Fraveling for a second?
Sure, about whether you want the reckless or...
There's something that has to be changed about the title. It's called fleeing to elude. I have attempting, that has to be removed. Defendant is guilty of fleeing to elude a law. Or what happened? Did we?
So earlier when we were going through potential lessors,
yeah.
Mr. Gilman said that he was not requesting the lesser fleeing or the reckless driving.
Okay.
So the,
okay. Great.
Because I had said initially maybe the lesser included of the fleeing to elude, or do you want no lessors at all?
No lessors.
No lessors.
Yeah.
Okay. So then,
all right. So what we're going to do though, Your Honor, is take away B and C.
Well, there's currently only B.
I might have a different version, but so A, right now I have A, B, D. So
right.
A would be the defendant is guilty of, let's see, how do you have it labeled on you? It'll be the defendant is guilty of fleeing to elude law enforcement officer, parentheses, sirens and lights activated. So it's consistent, I think.
Yes.
As charged. And then B would be the defendant is not guilty.
Yes, we just consulted, and the state is no longer requesting a lesser.
Right, I heard you.
Okay.
Okay. Or attempting.
Mr. Gilman, did you hear that?
I did.
Okay, so it's going to be A, B.
Yeah.
And you're just going to include lights and sirens, although just to be consistent. And then it has the correct month, year, place to be signed. It looks legally accurate. All right. Let's discuss this now. They have your last page submitting case to jury. Talking about what evidence would go back. Can you get both, Emily, can you pull out both knives for me? The ones that are not the butcher block. I don't want the butcher block. So my thought, folks, on evidence that can and cannot go back to the jurors. My thought is the butcher block with knives loose should not go back to the jury. That's too much of a danger. I could tell them that if they want to see that, they could just send a note. We can bring them into the courtroom and we could have that shown to them. The question is on these two items, whether they're secure and safe to go back to the jurors. What are your thoughts?
May I take a quick look?
Yeah, come on up. And Carl, you can express your concerns and thoughts. I think the bailiffs are hesitant to allow those to go back.
This is very easily can come out of this with no problem. Yeah.
Not only that, Your Honor, there is biohazard on there, so we can tell the members of the jury.
Oh, that's true. There's alleged blood on there, right?
It's not going back because of biohazard, but if they wish to see it, they can view it in front of all of us with the bailiff showing them again. They're all photographs of this evidence, so.
Mr. Gilman, what's your position? Are you okay with that?
I'm fine with that, Your Honor.
You are?
Yeah, and again, there's photographs of everything.
Okay.
There's
So I if it's a safety concern, I have no problem not taking with them just having the photographs.
Okay. And the state's okay with that?
Yes.
Okay, that's what we'll do.
So then. No butcher block, no knives.
What I'll do is I'll explain to them. So let's see, let's look at our jury instruction. During the trial, towards the bottom, folks, during the trial, items were received into evidence as exhibits. You may examine whatever exhibits you think will help you in your deliberations. A, and here's the options for us. A, some of these exhibits will be sent into the jury room with you when you begin to deliberate. And B, if you wish to see any other exhibits, please request that in writing.
I think both of those would be appropriate.
They apply. So let's just keep it the way it is. And I'll explain to them the only items that are not going back are the knives. And I'll explain that to them, that they just need to put that in a note and you could bring them in here for them to see it, okay? All right, so 3.13, submitting case to jury. It's fine, the instruction as it is. I have the closing argument instruction. You don't need to give that to the, you don't need to include that in the packet that goes to the jurors.
We'll take it out.
Are there any other instructions either side are requesting?
No, Your Honor.
And I can't think of any other instructions that apply as well. All right, so State, if you can make those changes, if you can send a copy to me and Mr. Gilman so we can have at least our updated version. We'll address it again at the close of the evidence. It's 9:22, we'll be adjourned. If you can be ready to start the trial at 11.
Yes, one thought, Your Honor. Do we want to discuss now, there is a DVD of the defendant's interview. The jury may wish to listen to that, or also the 911 calls. Did we want to talk about?
That all goes back to the jury.
Right,
to the,
but do they, are you going to explain to them how they can play it and do that sort of thing?
What I do is I bring IT in to just explain the jury card. I like to have that on the record, that the jury card doesn't do anything. It doesn't have access to the internet. All it can do is play the evidence. So I'll bring in Kevin or Henry, someone from IT. They'll wheel it in. They'll explain to them how it works, which is basically just a mouse, and all they can do is stop, pause, fast forward. And then I'll have Henry wheel it into the jury room.
Thank you.
Okay?
Yes, sir.
All right, have a nice break. Let's be ready to start the trial at 11 o'clock, okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Maybe seated. Bring Mr. Tower.
Please come here. Sears to transfer the copy.
No, I'm cold inside. I don't know if you knew that. You thought it was warm? Cool.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We have the defendant, Mr. Tower, prosecutors, defense attorney. Are both sides ready to proceed?
Yes, we are.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I think we have the state, your FDLE expert. After this witness, we're going to adjourn for lunch. We'll come back afterwards with Dr. Vega, is that right?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. All right, let's bring the jurors in.
Yes, sure. Representative.
All right, everybody may be seated. Welcome back, members of the jury. I hope you had a nice evening. The witness arrived, so we're ready to proceed. All right, State, please call your next witness.
State calls Charlene
Right here, raise the clerk, raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the
testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. Okay. Well, you may have that right.
Morning. State,
when you're ready, you may proceed.
Thank you.
Hello, Ms. Webster.
Hello.
Will you please tell us your full name and spell your last name?
Yes, my name is Charlene Webster. Last name is spelled W-E-B-S-T-E-R.
How are you employed, Ms. Webster?
I am a senior crime laboratory analyst with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement at the Tampa Bay Regional Operations Center in the biology section.
How long have you worked for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement?
Since December of 2009.
Will you tell the members of the jury about your formal education, please?
I have a Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology and a Bachelor of Science in Biochemistry from the University of Miami. I also hold a Master of Science in Pharmacy with a concentration in Forensic DNA and Serology from the University of Florida.
Thank you. Will you also tell us a little bit about the duties and responsibilities of a senior crime lab analyst?
Yes. As an analyst, I examine items of evidence for the presence of body fluids such as blood, semen, or saliva. I also examine them for any skin cells that may be present from items that may have been handled, touched, or worn. I will take samplings of those items of evidence to try to develop a DNA profile that I can then compare to the DNA profiles of known individuals that are believed to be involved in the case. I will put a statistical weight if I'm able to do that and produce a report.
What is DNA?
DNA stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. It is the genetic blueprint for life, and it makes us who we are. Your DNA profile is unique, except in the case of identical twins. You inherit half of your DNA from your biological mother and the other half from your biological father. Your DNA is found all throughout your body, so except for mature red blood cells, and your DNA doesn't change over your life. So the DNA I would find in your hair would be the same DNA I would expect to find in your blood.
What method of DNA analysis do you use up at the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's office in Tampa?
We use STR testing, which stands for short tandem repeats. And STRs are just small segments that are found throughout the DNA. The number of times those repeating segments are observed varies from individuals. And as I mentioned earlier, since you get half from your mother and half from your father, the number of repeats you get from each person would vary. That process is done in four steps. So what I'm going to try to do in the first step is I'm going to take that sample of the evidence and I'm going to place it in a tube. I'm going to add some liquid and some heat. And the purpose of that is just to try to break open those cells so they can release the DNA so I can see what's available to me. The second step is then now to make many copies of the 21 locations on the DNA strand that I'm actually looking at. And I'm trying to make those copies so that way I can get a better idea of the DNA profile. The third step is now, the second step, I misspoke, was determining how much DNA I actually have present. Once I opened up those cells, how much DNA is available to me? The third step is making millions of copies of the 21 locations on the DNA strand that I'm looking at. And then the last step is just separating those copied DNA by size, so that way I end up with peaks on a graph, much like an EKG. And those peaks are your DNA profile for each of the 21 areas of the DNA I'm looking at.
That method that you just described, short tandem repeat, is that supported in the scientific community?
Yes, it is.
By published scientific literature?
Yes.
Okay. Now, your lab in Tampa, is it accredited?
Yes, we are.
With whom is it accredited?
We are accredited by ANAB, which is the American National Standards Institute National Accreditation Board.
And as an individual crime laboratory analyst, do you have some sort of continuing education or accreditation that you have to do personally?
Yes, I do have to do 16 hours of continuing education each calendar year. In addition, I do have to take what's called a proficiency test twice a year. A proficiency test is just a scenario-based test that's given to me from an outside agency. I know I'm being tested, but I don't know the results of the test. Once I receive the samples, I will take the samples from start to finish, just as I would any other caseworking sample using our standard operating procedures. Once I get my results, I submit it to the testing agency, who then ensures that my results are consistent with theirs, and they will report that back to ANAB, our accrediting body, and to FDLE as well.
When was the last proficiency test that you undertook?
Earlier this year, and I passed it.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. You talked about your protocols. How do you ensure that the results that you achieve in your laboratory are correct? How do you know that you're getting the correct results? What steps do you take?
We have controls that are run with all of our samples. So as I mentioned earlier, as a part of that STR process, that I took a sample of the item of evidence to do through the four steps. Well, I'm also going to do that with what's called a reagent blank. So it's just an empty tube, and everything that happens to my sample happens to that tube through all four steps of the STR process. That's called a negative control, and that just ensures that no outside DNA is being introduced into the samples. In addition, there's also a positive control that's run through the samples to just ensure that all of the reagents are performing and the instruments are performing the way that they should and producing the expected results that is received from that positive control.
Right. As an analyst, do you maintain neutrality when you are working with items that have been submitted to you by various agencies and throughout the testing process?
Yes.
Why is it important for you to maintain a neutral attitude about the evidence that comes into you for testing?
When I receive the evidence, I don't know what to expect as a result, so I'm just going to conduct my testing as I would with every other item that's similar. I'm going to send it through the same process, of course, not to be biased in any way, just to perform it and to try to get any DNA profiles that may be usable in the case.
Thank you. Now, you mentioned a little bit earlier about statistical analysis is used in as part of the procedure for ultimate DNA analysis. Do you have specialized training in statistics?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the training that you've received in statistics?
So I took statistics as a part of my master's class. In addition to during the training program at FDLE, we are trained on the statistics that we perform, which is currently likelihood ratio. In addition to the training that I received from FDLE, the members of the program that we use also did a two-week statistical training class on the system, and so I did get that training as well.
Does the Florida Department of Law Enforcement use a particular database as part of your statistical analysis?
Yes, we do.
Can you explain a little bit about that database, please?
The database we use is developed from the National Institutes of Standard and Technology. That database was published in the Forensic Science International Journal of Forensics in 2013. And basically that database contains DNA profiles from random people who were samples that were purchased, and the DNA types that were observed there are just telling me how common or how rare a particular allele or DNA type may be observed in the general population across three ethnicities. The ethnicities we look at are Caucasian, Hispanic, and African American, as those are the three common ethnicities found in the state of Florida.
Okay. Why do you use a numerical weight or a statistical weight as part of the DNA analysis?
We add a statistical weight to a sample that is a match, which means that I compared a single source or profile from one individual to a known individual, or an inclusion where I'm comparing an individual to what's called a mixture, where that's from two or more individuals. It gives a statistical weight as to how common or how rare, given the DNA evidence, how likely it is to see that DNA evidence how likely it is to see that that DNA evidence given the profile that is observed The statistical weight gives I'm looking at the DNA profile and I'm comparing a known individual to the profile, either to a single source or a mixture. It just gives weight as to how common or how rare that DNA profile may be observed. Sorry.
Okay. Essentially, does that allow you to put into perspective the results as to how much of that person's DNA is in that particular sample?
It's actually just saying it's comparing two different scenarios and giving a weight. It's comparing how likely that DNA profile could be from the person of interest or an unknown individual. So it's not telling me that that person is actually in the profile. It's just telling me what is the likelihood that the evidence could be from the person of interest versus an unknown individual.
All right, thank you. Now, have you ever testified in court with regard to DNA analysis?
Yes.
How many times, approximately, Ms. Webster?
Probably about 50-ish.
Okay. And can you give us an idea of where in the state of Florida you've given testimony on DNA?
I've gone as high as Tallahassee, and I've gone as further south as Fort Myers, where we have our different regions. So any of the courthouses in between there, I've probably touched on a few of them.
All right, great. Now, I want to ask you about how, as an FDLE analyst, how do you determine or examine an item of evidence to know if there is blood on that item? Can you explain that process to us?
Yes, if I'm examining an item of evidence, I'm going to look at it to see if it has red-brown staining that may be possibly present, as that's somewhat characteristics of what a blood stain would look like. If I observe red-brown staining on the item, I'm going to perform what's called a presumptive test, which is just a chemical change test that tells me whether or not blood is probably present, but what it possibly isn't. I cannot confirm that it is blood, but I can say that blood is possibly present. That color change test takes a clear liquid, and it turns pink if blood is possibly present.
Okay. Did you receive known samples in this particular case of the defendant Dima Tower and also Jennifer and Robbie Tower?
Yes, I did.
In what forms did you receive those known samples, Ms. Webster?
I received a buccal swab from Dima Tower, and I received a blood stain card from Robbie Tower and a blood stain card from Jennifer Tower.
Okay. Now, as to the buccal swab from Dima Tower, did you obtain a complete DNA profile for Dima Tower?
Yes, I did.
And as to the bloodstain cards, did you obtain complete DNA profiles for both Jennifer Tower and Robbie Tower?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so did you also receive items of evidence, or did your lab receive items of evidence from the Northport Police Department?
Yes, we did.
Can you please tell the members of the jury And without going through the entire list, if you could just tell us about items 6.1 and 7.8.
May I refer to my notes?
You may, if it would help to refresh your recollection.
Item 6.1 is described as a DNA sample that was taken from the knife blade.
Okay, and 6.1, was that derived from a kitchen knife?
Yes.
Thank you. And then as to item 7.8, can you tell us what that item of evidence is?
Item 7.8 is described as a DNA sample from knife 6's handle.
Okay, thank you. All right. So speaking specifically of those two items, 6.1, the knife blade, and 7.8, the knife handle, and those are from two distinct knives.
That's correct.
Thank you. Okay. Did FDLE test those items?
Yes, we did.
Okay. Can you please explain the initial results of that test?
Item 6 is the kitchen knife did give chemical indications for the presence of blood. That means I did that presumptive color change test that I described earlier, there was a color change for pink. So the results that it was, it gave chemical indications for blood.
All right, and what about 7.8? Just as to the blood, the serology.
That's right. Yes. So there was chemical indications for the presence of blood on item 7.8 as well.
Thank you. Now let's go back to 6.1. Once you found the chemical indications for the presence of blood on that knife blade, what was the next step in the analysis?
After that, I would have taken there was a sampling taken of the knife handle and the blade, and then the samples would have been placed in a tube that I described earlier and taken through that four-step process as I described it in order to try to develop a DNA profile for each of those items.
Okay. And what were the DNA results that you obtained from the knife blade, item 6.1?
So for item 6.1, the knife blade, the DNA results obtained demonstrated the presence of a mixture consistent with two donors, including at least one male contributor.
Okay, and were you able to determine of any of those donors in that particular item, 6.1, the knife blade?
I was able to include Dima Tower as a possible contributor to the mixed DNA profile. The observed mixed DNA profile is approximately 61,000 times more likely to occur if the sample originated from Dima Tower and one unrelated individual than if it originated from two unrelated individuals.
Were you also given an indication of one of the other donors in that mixture?
I was able to include Robbie Tower as a possible contributor to the mixed DNA profile. The observed mixed DNA profile is greater than 700 billion times more likely to occur if the sample originated from Robbie Tower and one unrelated individual than from two unrelated individuals.
Okay, so if we can break that down just into layperson's language, can you just simplify that for the members of the jury?
As I mentioned in the statistic, at its giving away, the type of statistic I'm giving you is called a likelihood ratio, and it's comparing two opposing hypotheses. So it's comparing whether or not the person of interest could be given the DNA profile, the person of interest could be the donor of the profile versus if an unknown individual could be the donor of the evidence profile observed. In this case, I'm giving weight to whether or not if Dima Tower is included, the likelihood for the given the DNA profile is approximately 67,000 more likely, times more likely to occur if it originated from him versus non-related individual. I'm giving weight more to each of those scenarios, and it's on a sliding scale. So if one, a likelihood ratio of one just means that it's neutral. It doesn't give weight to either one of those scenarios. As you get higher above one, the number one, it gives weight more to my first scenario of the person of interest being the possible donor of that DNA profile. As it gets lower from one, it's stating that it's supporting more of that second hypothesis, or that an unknown individual is the one that donated that DNA profile.
Thank you. Now let's move on to the knife handle from 7.8, the other knife, the second knife. Can you please tell us about the results after you did your analysis, Ms. Webster?
The DNA results for item 7.8 demonstrated the presence of a mixture of at least two donors, including at least one male contributor. A complete DNA profile for the major contributor could be determined and is suitable for comparisons. Due to the limited nature of the DNA results for the additional contributors to the mixture, that data wasn't interpretable. So I'm only making comparisons to the major DNA profile. This major DNA profile matched the DNA profile from Robbie Tower. The observed major DNA profile is greater than 700 billion times more likely to occur if the sample originated from Robbie Tower than from an unrelated individual.
Thank you. Now, I just want to ask you a question regarding this particular evidence. So these knives were in a kitchen, and presumably they were used by all the members of the family at any given time. The family members being Robbie Tower, Jennifer Tower, and Dima Tower. So what distinguishes the DNA that you found on these two knives? What's the distinction? Is it because you found chemical indications for the presence of blood as opposed to touch DNA?
Objection leading?
Yeah, let's try not to be so leading in your question.
Thank you.
Do you understand the question as a general concept? Can you explain touch DNA versus blood DNA? Okay, I think that's the question.
Yes. Please.
Blood DNA from blood, blood is as a body fluid in general, would produce more DNA or leave more DNA behind than just touching an item. However, I can't say in this case as to which one those came from, as the knives may have been handled as stated by everyone throughout the family. I can't state whether or not the DNA is exclusively from blood or from epithelial cells.
Thank you. But based upon your analysis, were there chemical indications for the presence of blood on both knives?
Yes, there was.
Thank you. May I have a moment, please?
Ma'am.
Thank you very much. I don't have anything else.
Mr. Gilman, when you're ready.
Good morning, ma'am. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, yourself.
All right. So when you're examining these items of evidence, you examine essentially what's submitted, right?
Correct.
You don't go to the individual law enforcement headquarters and pick and choose what they give to you.
That is correct.
All right. So if they give you, for example, an actual physical knife, you would go through and do all of the swabbing yourself, correct?
Correct.
If they don't give you the physical knife, they just give you whatever the swabs are, you test from the swabs, correct?
Correct.
So you're entirely at the discretion of what is submitted to you as far as what gets tested?
Correct.
All right. And that system is automated, correct?
What do you mean by automated?
I mean, you don't go in with like a pair of tweezers and pull out DNA, right?
No, I don't use a tweezer to go in. I do the process that we described.
Right. It's automated through machinery, right?
Yes. There are some hands-on portions, but yes, there are some machinery that helps with that.
And the peaks and valleys are essentially computer
generated results, correct?
Correct.
All right. The statistical analysis that you do has changed since you started in 2009, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Okay. And it used to be that you would give numbers like one in 15 and make like sounding like really horrible made up numbers for a statistical analysis, correct? And you'd have to count the number of zeros to describe the number?
Yes, we still do that. They're still big numbers now.
Okay. But it sounds to me like you said that the two times that you discovered Robbie Towers' DNA, that statistical likelihood was 700 billion times more likely, correct?
I stated that it's greater than 700 billion times more likely.
Okay. And then for the one instance where you indicated that you found Dima Tower in a mixture, it was 67,000, correct?
Approximately 61,000.
Okay. I think you said both 61 and 67. So it's 61?
It's 61,000.
Okay. And that's obviously closer to zero than 700 billion, right?
Yes.
Okay. And again, we're talking about a mixture, correct?
Yes, for all both right. samples.
And using the statistical analysis the way that you do, if you were to use a separate database than the one that you use, would you expect similar or different results?
Objection calls for speculation.
Would you be speculating, or do you know the answer to that?
I generally know the answer to that.
All right, I'll overrule the objection. You can answer it.
It would be slightly different, but I wouldn't expect there to be more than a tenfold difference.
Right, so back when you're talking about the big, huge numbers, if we're talking 700 billion, the tenfold difference would be 70 billion, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Nothing further, Judge.
State any redirect of the witness?
Did you find blood on those two knives?
Yes, I did find the possible indications for blood, yes.
Okay. And in addition, did you also find DNA from Robbie Tower and Dima Tower?
I was able to include Robbie Tower and Dima Tower on item 6.1.
And is that the bottom line of your report? In the most simplistic reductionist terms, is that the bottom line of your report?
Those are the results of my reporting, yes.
Thank you very much.
Is the witness free to step down?
Yes.
No objection.
All right, you may step down, ma'am. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Brooks, as you recall, when we talked about scheduling, this is the witness this morning. The next witness is not available till 1 o'clock. So let's see, it's 11:51. Is an hour enough for you folks for lunch? I see the jurors say that's fine. Does that work for the parties?
It does, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Let's start back up.
Dr. Vega is 1:15. Let's make it 1:15. Sorry.
1:15, okay. We'll see everybody at 1:15, okay? Please leave your notepads turned over, face down, writing implements on top. Have a nice lunch. Remember, do not discuss anything with each other and don't observe. All right, do we have all the jurors up?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. State, do you have your witness here?
Yes.
All right, is the state ready to proceed?
It is.
Defense ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, let's bring the jurors in. All right, everybody may be seated. Welcome back, members of the jury. All right, State, please call your next witness.
State calls Dr. Russell Vega.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you come over here.
Thank you.
Right up that way.
Are you ready, State?
Yes, thank you.
Attorney, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
Will you please tell us your full name and spell your last name?
My full name is Russell Scott Vega. The last name is spelled V-E-G-A.
Dr. Vega, what is your profession?
I'm a forensic pathologist or medical examiner.
All right. And what are the duties of a medical examiner?
The medical examiner's job is to investigate certain deaths. Those deaths are specified in statute or state law. And more or less, the deaths that the medical examiner is supposed to investigate are non-natural deaths, violent deaths, deaths that occur as a result of anything other than natural disease.
All right. And what is your jurisdiction as a medical examiner?
As the district medical examiner for this current district of District 12, my jurisdiction includes DeSoto and Manatee counties, as well as Sarasota County.
Will you tell the jury a little bit about your formal education, please?
Certainly. I got my undergraduate degree at Florida State University. I majored in physics and biochemistry at FSU. After graduating there, I went to medical school at the University of South Florida in Tampa. Following medical school, I did 2 years of training in general surgery and then 4 years of training in anatomic and clinical pathology. And pathology is the subspecialty of medicine that deals with diagnosing diseases by looking at fluids, different laboratory tests, biopsies, organs removed at surgery, and by doing autopsies. And after all of that, I did a one-year fellowship or subspecialty year in forensic pathology, and that's the branch of pathology which specializes in autopsy and in death investigations.
What is an autopsy?
An autopsy is an examination that is performed on somebody who's died, and that exam can be performed for different reasons, but generally it's to identify any diseases, complications, anatomic abnormalities, injuries, or other things which might be of interest to either doctors who order that or in our realm for medical examiner autopsies to figure out what the cause and the manner of death are.
All right. Thank you. So I want to take you back to September 3rd of 2023, Doctor.
Yes.
Did you go to the death scene in this case?
Yes, I did.
And you tell the members of the jury What are the advantages or the reasons for a medical examiner such as you to go to the death scene itself?
By examining the scene of a death where the body is still there, there is certain information which can be gathered, which can be helpful in the coming process of doing the autopsy at some later point, or to gather information which might be useful for law enforcement or other agencies at that point in their investigation. Some of the things that are of value in that scene investigation then are the ability to try to put together the circumstances that led up to the death, the evaluation of where the actual injuries that led to death occurred and whether or not they occurred elsewhere or at the site where the body was, and to get an idea of what the nature of the injuries or potential injuries before we get out there, perhaps we don't know, but the nature of the injuries that led to the person's death. Finally, we might get information that leads us to a rough estimate of how long a person has been deceased and at that site.
Okay, and that is a rough estimate, isn't it, Doctor?
Very rough, yes.
Okay, because on TV shows, you always have a detective saying, how long has this person been dead? And the doctor says, 2 hours and 27 minutes. Is that possible?
It is possible with certain elements, such as some kind of device which is tracing an individual's vital signs at the time, or even better, a surveillance video or something of that nature.
Right.
But just based on the autopsy findings, it can almost never be that precise.
Okay, thank you. So after you went to the death scene and did that examination that you talked about, looking at the circumstances surrounding it, the nature of the wounds, et cetera, did there come a time when the bodies of Robbie and Jennifer Tower were transported to the morgue?
Yes.
Okay. And did you perform an autopsy on both Mr. and Mrs. Tower, Robbie and Jennifer Tower?
Yes, I performed autopsies on each of them.
When did those autopsies take place?
So the autopsies were performed on September 3rd of 2023.
Okay.
Doctor, I'm showing you have been marked for identification as States Exhibit 34A through 34K, and that includes double G, so 34G and 34GG. Take a look at those for me, please.
Certainly.
More of the Evil Orphan murder trial of Dima Tower is coming up. Fresh, subscribe now so you don't miss a moment from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.